Thank you all. Is that okay? Sounds okay?
Yes.
Yeah. A bit nervous with microphones. First time, actually, I was in the Don Valley, but downstairs was also the first time I met Gregory Abinhu, a very good friend of mine. I'm not sure if many of you have died in 2005. So I'm going to read a poem for Gregory. We spent quite a lot of time together in the late 1970s, particularly in the late 1970s, we were both in Canada. So quite a few things in the poem are a bit, what should I say, between ourselves, and I'm just going to indicate a few of those kind of things. The poem begins actually in, I think, 1977, yeah. When we were in Pennsylvania, so it just kind of says Harrisburg, Penn, yeah, so that's Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and there's a reference to somebody called his Nibs of Beacon Hill, and that's actually Robert Lowell, who we kind of failed to meet during that trip, and then Greg was very fond of quoting a little bit of Doggerel from Patrick Kavanagh. He saved up to send us to Chatto and Windus. Yeah. And that was his kind of shorthand, word code for getting published by an English publisher. And then there's just, I mentioned the Ouse, and that's the River Ouse, which is in, I think it's in Yorkshire, not sure. And then there's a little reference to somebody called Chief, if you can, it should be Chieftain, if you can, and that's the poem by Wallace Stevens, and He's the 10-foot poet among inchlings. So the poem is called The Hip Flask. So this is for a little bit of feedback or something. Is it all right?
Yeah? That's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. The Hip Flask. When 28 years ago the bus climbs uphill and we climbed forever out of Harrisburg, Penn, you offered me the hip flask wrapped in its indigo sleeve and thanked the tailor. The world's only a blue bag moss, knock a squeeze out of it while you can. I taste the sweet rye a May morning as we head for Boston and Robbie's. No inkling of what's ahead that summer when we'll miss his nibs of Beacon Hill, but check out the aquarium. Through the glass fence scan, the giant finned sharks touring their high-rise pen. It brought to mind your guppy tank unbrocked by blue Ontario's shore, where in truth all was about to go up in flames, the marriage of young minds undergo alteration as impediments came to a head. When love struck again as love will out of the blue, and with new squeeze, white goddess, the raven gale, you take wing for Grantham, to frolic in the open sesame, hey-ho, of Maggie's England, in which canard worms, surely, you were doomed like the last Mohican. You never made it up the Cindus, it was no go the TLS, no way, Queen Square, not putting a pen to paper for years, since it seems you'd plunged head first into a tide of doubt and were careering downhill at knots. But the wind turned, an uncanny breeze blew you home to Cork, where skies cleared, climbed blue, improbably, briefly, two neat books in the can, with one more, your mysterious late excellence, on the go, the night you show up, bone dry, frail, in Carrigtool, to launch my floods, brandishing it above your head, as outside on cue, the millennial heavens open. We were back in the bantership of the old weakened pen, disputing into the dawn ifs and buts of poems to blue in the face. The heartache of it all goes to my head. I'm on the ooze today, adamant as chief if you can, you claim we're rowing downstream. No question, all go till we face the weir. Do you think moss, the water, flows uphill? If only, Gregor, then the staff must end. Cancel the day, we'll ferry you upstream to the hills of Pennsylvania. and the blue flask replenish for the long years ahead. But you don't apply the poem. Stars and jasmine. Each of them has been a god many times. Cat, hedgehog, and our summer interloper, the tortoise. A perfect triangle, they can neither eat nor marry one another. And tonight they are gods under the jasmine, under the stars. Already the hedgehog has scoffed the cat supper, and she's walked nonplussed beside him, escaping headlong into the bushes. Wisely now, she keeps an eye on him there, and on the tortoise, noisily crisscrossing the gravel. For the cat, jasmine is white, but the stars have colours. For the hedgehog, there are no stars, only a sky of jasmine, against which she sniffs something dark, outlined like a bird of prey. Wisely, the tortoise ignores both jasmine and stars. Isn't it enough, she says, to carry the sky on your back, a sky that is solid, mathematical, and delicately coloured, on which someone too has painted our neighbour's address, 9A Surrey Road. Come September, we will post her through their letterbox. So it's called the water spider, which is a very common little creature that lives in ponds and so on. And there's only one species, in fact, of water spider. They're very common. The water spider. Each time the common water spider sticks her backside up out of the garden pond, the fine hairs on her abdomen trap air and allow her to sink through the water with it. There she goes, a bauble of mercury, shimmering like a fish lure and at risk from the carp until she reaches the tangle of weeds where she's hung her silken tent. She slides the bubble into it, inflating a small dome, a diving bell no engineer can match, since it exchanges dead air for oxygen through the thin integument. Later, she builds a chamber to hatch her eggs and lives off prey in easy reach. Once or twice, she'll come to the surface to moult or else fetch more air. Later still, she'll steal her capsule for the winter. She's taken spinneret and silk to water and skewed the theology. Less fierce than her relatives in air, she welcomes courtship and is smaller than her male, whom she neither eats nor poisons. I kind of knew when I came in I'd have to read a poem about a horse. Congratulations to Trotting Weasel. She came in at last, although it was an expensive pint. And of course there is our horse's head there again, looking at me. And actually this is, I read this poem for two people I met tonight, Michael and Cassie, who know a little bit more about this, the backside of this poem than I do. It's called The Parlour. Keegan's land bordered on ours, though they lived in Carrigtwohill in a house with a horse's head sticking out of their front wall. His four strong legs occupied the parlour and his tail hung too close to the fire, my father said. Until the day I followed him in to find chairs, the table set, and covering the place where the head had been severed was a picture of Pope Pius.
How many people have seen the horse's head in Carrington?
Yeah.
Have
you? Yeah,
sure. Man knows it.
I can't
see. Yeah. It's not the only place. No, no. It's kind of a feature of it. Is this? Yeah. Yeah. It sort of introduces the next series of poems. I'm going to read because it was true that Keegan's land did border an ours, and I'm going to read it. Some poems about the actual farm that I grew up on, and they're in prose form. They're what I call idylls, little pictures of country life. At the end of this one. Another day, when they were sitting on the headland in the small fields, the men discussed the changes they had seen, and a debate arose about what was the greatest change that happened in their lifetime. "What do you think?" my father asked Danjo. "The steam tractor was a great change," the trucker answered, "and then the motor car. But the greatest of all, to my mind, was the cutter and binder." "That was a great change," my father said. "And you, Alf, what would you say?" "When the dam was built at Ardna Cresha, it flooded farmland in 7 parishes," said the Gully. "Yes, that was a great and a terrible change," my father agreed. "Moss, you've seen more than any of us. What's your opinion?" "Women's fashion," the forester replied. "Girls, these days, and next to nothing at mass." My father nodded. "That too is a great change." And the rest chipped in, and everyone had a different opinion about what was the greatest change in their lifetime. Television, the creamery, penicillin, Shannon Airport, the price of stout, Paul's teeth, tourists, the electric fence, plastic bags, weed killer. "There are a lot of changes," my father said. Moss turned to him. "Tell us, Martin, what do you think?" My father fished in his inside pocket and took out a small framed photo of a woman in a white hat and veil, smiling happily. "That," he said, "is my mother on her honeymoon." Various characters that kind of recur in this sequence of idylls, and one of them is called the boatswain. He's sometimes referred to as son, but the reason he's called the boatswain is he kind of comes into this world and he's not used to sort of farm work and so on, because when he's asked to the shaft on the side with a whetstone, he kind of saws it back and forth across it like that. So one of the other people says to him, "Not as if you're playing the fiddle with the boatswain." And then he, for that reason, he acquires his nickname of the boatswain. Yeah. But he comes into this one, I think. Yeah, I already does very definitely. Oh, well, it actually is a subscript when he comes into more, but I've now told the story anyway, so it will be. I won't need to do it again. "We're more or less standing on the water table. The men were in the bog, waist deep in muddy ground. They were cutting a drain from the pond to the stream. The hope was to free up land for pasture, and my father was following instructions from the department engineer. You could say the water is meant to run from head to toe, while the people go east and west across it. In former times," he explained, "an old road came through the farm and exited by Keegan's Passage onto the Pound Road in a way towards the city. By day, and even at night, there was a traffic of carts and people driving animals, of men on horseback, tinkers, hawkers, constabulary, all sorts, who might stop at the pump for talk and refreshment. Were there no rogues and thieves in those days? Asked Davy Devine. A duck or a rabbit might go missing, never anything of value. Though the road's no longer in use, there are still those who know, said Moss. Tramps and trappers and such like, they hold on to things longer than most, and they remember the paths and where the stepping stones are. So that's how you'd find Carney the Knacker or Snoop Buckley asleep beside you on a cold morning. If it's beside you, he'd be, son. But you were saying about the water. Well, in Alice Warren's time, they diverted the water to create a lake. What was a lake for? God only knows, Moss said. The Warrens were English. Pleasure, I suppose. My father traced the course of the water along the south side of the paddock. There it looped around like a moat outside the high stone walls of the yard. He pointed to the hollow where the geese were grazing below the lane gate. You can see the brook land is taken over, and it's a softer green. That's where it was. By now the men had stopped their work. They had climbed out of the drain and were looking back across the rushes and furze bushes towards the farmyard, picturing what it must have been like. A lake, said Davy at last. A pleasure lake. And then some of the poems in the book are, I don't know, they're a little bit more rambunctious, I suppose, a little bit more... it will sort of, what should I say, they kind of screen out the harsher aspects of things, and didn't want it to be entirely like that, you know. So, this one actually, I should say that there are actually 18 of those idols, and I had a notion in my head, there are 18 fields in the farm, write a poem for each of the fields, and then also I thought, you know, it's a bit like a golf course, yeah? You know, we go from one point. And so there are a lot of golfing jokes in the course of them. And then I wrote a poem which is called, which is a type of poem, it's called a cento, where you kind of steal your everything in the poem, or nearly everything in the poem, from other poems. It makes it a bit easier to do it that if you do it that way. but I complicated it a bit by stealing the first line from Sandy Lyle from the golf room. So, first line is Sandy Lyle. I think it's Sandy Lyle, I'm not sure. It's the golf room anyway. And then the rest is, well, some of it will be familiar to you anyway. Yeah. And it's sort of in my, it is in my father's voice. Yeah. He begins with a line by Sandy Lyle. There's more to life than hitting a golf ball, and more to life than this bitch, the farming life. More to it than lying in a hammock at Bill Duffy's farm. There's more to life than wasting one's life. Though there's more life in wasters than you'd think. So it's more thinking what life is like than it is the thing itself. But the thing about life is it's crazier and more of it than you think. And the more there is, the more we want. And what we want, we live to regret. For what one wants, one gets too late or spends too quick. Getting and regretting, we lay waste our powers. And it is the waste remains and kills. One could do worse. And lay in a hammock all one's life, and take up late in life the game of golf. And this one is kind of a similar idea. In this case, it begins with a line by CJ. CJ was a character in Paul and Rise of Reginald Carr.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And began with his most famous catchphrase and just carried on from there. And then it was, you know, I was just kind of wanted to get in both of these poems something of the kind of physical quality of my father's voice. I didn't get where I am by wearing underpants decorated with Beethoven or the red flag, my father said, or even the Turin shroud. I didn't get where I am on the Orient Express I didn't get where I am by taking night classes in Chinese. I didn't get where I am by taking my eye off the ball, by putting the cart in front of the horse, or by turning the other cheek. I didn't get where I am eating figs and olives and gherkins. I didn't get where I am in Malibu. I didn't get where I am with yoga, feng shui, cranial massage, or acupuncture. I didn't get where I am in wigwams. I didn't get where I am on the snows of Kilimanjaro, or in a pilgrimage to St. James of Compostela, nor did I get where I am because your mother prayed every night to St. Jude. I didn't get where I am beholden to any man. I didn't get where I am at the Fla Kill. I didn't get where I am at the Munster Final. I didn't get where I am at the Sorbonne. I didn't get where I am in the pub, club, or clubhouse. I didn't get where I am in the Camel's Back. Nor did I get where I am in the Order of the Golden Dawn, or by joining the Royal Society for the Protection of Bullshit. I didn't get where I am by thinking it would all sound a lot better in Italian. If you could put a tune to it, if only it were in Aramaic or Mandarin Chinese. No, that's not how I got where I am. The men have come home flaming from Pigeon Hill races. On clear evenings, the walls of the old deer park gave back an echo. It was a starlit night at the end of May, and we were woken in the small hours by the rumpus from the haggard. Davy and son were giving it a go. Goldfinger! Goldfinger! They frightened the little creatures. They'll wake the whole country. They'll wake the dead woman. My father had appeared in his nightshirt. He took the shotgun down from the hog stand and loaded both its bars and flung wide the back door. The night air blew in. O'Riordan! O'Riordan! Hand the heifer! Hand the heifer! I'll give them what for? Martin, no, let them be. They're only play acting. She smiled at him. Besides, they might set the dog on you. We could see over his shoulder the moon in swift flight above the tops of the Scots pines. The cold draft blew the loose shirt against his knees and chest. He pulled the door to again. I suppose they'll wear out. He withdrew the cartridges and replaced the gun from the hall stand. Goldfinger had begun to howl, and Keegan's collie replied faintly from the distance. The poor, motherless bastards, my father said, turning to the bedroom. They'll have heads on them tomorrow morning. She told you that Goldfinger is the dog. I was going to change it, bring in more of Keegan's for music, but
you read the one about your find your dad at the
stream. I will in a minute. Yeah. It's a mystery where he's gone. It was the morning after dragging the river. In Highland had been fishing for trout with onion bags and had drowned in a pool. The men had worked through the night by the light of storm lamps, but the body hadn't been recovered. They had come to see to the cows and were drinking whiskey in the old house while their clothes dried before the fire. It's a mystery how it happened in the first place. They said when he went under, he never came to the surface again, but they thought they heard him call three times. His foot must have been caught by a root. Maybe he was pulled down by a current or a whirlpool. It's not as if this is a backwater. They say, it takes 3 lines a year, said Davy Devine. The bodies often turn up miles downstream or are washed in from the ocean months after. I wouldn't want to be the one to come upon them then, said Moss. Still, they say it's not the worst way to go. I always drown the kittens and pups, said Joe. Better that than stringing them from the clothesline or feeding them to the sow like the gully does. I think it must be frightening to die under the water. Why do you think that, son? Because how would you be able to say the act of contrition? The men laughed. Maybe you should keep away from those Coakley sisters. My father said, I think, son, it would be enough to repeat the words in your head. I'll just finish with the last of these idylls, because time has passed and so on, and not all the characters are around. So I think the dog is. Would you like to know? I finish reading from the Holy Land with this one, and then I read. What was it? What did you ask for?
The one about find your dad is sitting on the street.
Okay, alright, yeah. Davy, the boatswain, and myself were with my porter topping beat in Buckley's fields. We pulled the muddy tubers out of the ground, trimmed the roots with the blade, then sliced off the green heads and tossed the finished beet into a wicker barrel. A northeast wind was blowing down from the Ganges and sending black squalls of rain and sleet across the open country. The light faded and my father proposed a halt. We stood together in the lee of the beach. It's no beauty spot, the dead end of October. On fine nights, my father said, moths used to lie out in the old lime kiln under the stars. One time he nodded off, and he damn near finished up in the kiln. The bosun said, he likes lying on the haggard wall after supper and listening to the wind and the pines. The air in the haggard is soft, almost like a woman's breath. You can't ever have been in the van, which I am Dave then. But Davy said he preferred company, even if it was only someone to argue with. Oftentimes now he sat by the well and played a tune on the whistle, just to myself and the hound. And what about you, boss, who knows every rood of the land? What is your favourite haunt? My father said it was Coleman's Glen, where the slow bush straddles the stream, and there's never a soul, only the birds. That's the place I'll be spending my holidays. It's kind of out of place, but I, you know.
It's in the book.
Yeah, it is. And Salinas is he's a bit like Pan. He's the father of the satyrs, yeah? So it was kind of an introductory poem to the Ills in a way. And just, I don't need to say this really, but I would say it anyway, give myself a bit of, to draw breath a little bit. It begins with a reference to my mother's dinner call, which was kind of a weird kind of yodeling sound, and it had the virtue that had carried great distances. Silence. Her dinner call failed, and we went looking in outbuildings along the ditches and the drains. An unnamed fear stilled the hedges, and the fields were suddenly close and listening. But we found him safe and sound, asleep beside the screen, his head propped on a bag of nitrogen, his Wellington boots under the alders. When he blinked awake and offered us that sheepish grin, I guessed he just folded away the wood notes and hidden the pipe in his dungarees. Thank you very much.